Nate hissed. The front sight of the gun fit neatly between the buck brush man's widening eyes.
I'm Earl Wright. Don't shoot me. Don't shoot me.
He was stammering.
Where are Kurt and Laura?
Who?
Wright asked, genuinely confused.
The people who used to live here.
Oh, is that who they were?
Nate's finger tightened on the trigger and Wright saw it.
I never met them, Wright said quickly. I'm just doing what I was told to do. I don't know anything about no Kurt and Laura. From what I understand, they moved out a few weeks ago.
Then why are you here?
My company bought the place, Wright said. I guess one of the executives wants to live on a ranch. I don't know much more than that. I was told to come out here and clean the place out. I just do what I'm told. If you have an issue with it, I'm not the guy to talk to.
Nate believed him. He lowered the weapon to Wright's belt buckle.
Hell, Wright said. I'm a coal miner. I live in Hanna, and I didn't have a job once they closed the mines up there. This is the only thing I could find. Buckbrush is the only outfit hiring right now. When I'm told to do something, I don't ask too many questions about why.
The possible scenario made some sense. The Buchholz Ranch was kept afloat by Dr. Buchholz's medical practice, not by the income generated by the cattle operation. Nate knew that. It was a similar story on most small family-owned operations. The good doctor was getting old. The only day a small ranch was successful financially was the day it was sold.
So Buckbrush bought them out?
I guess so, Wright said. I wasn't privy to any of the details.
Nate said,
Are you telling me they left this house without taking all their stuff?
They took some, all right, Wright said. I'm just getting the rest.
Where are you taking it?
Wright hesitated for a moment.
The dump?
Nate felt his anger spike again. Despite the difficult financial circumstances they were in, Nate couldn't see the doctor leaving his ranch in such a rush unless pressure had been applied.
If you want the stuff, you can have it,
Wright said, gesturing toward the items in the back of the truck.
Take anything you want.
Nate felt like shooting him, but he didn't. Earl Wright wasn't the problem.
Who are you anyway? Wright asked.
A friend of theirs. Do you have any idea where they moved?
Not a clue, but I hope somewhere warm, Wright said.
Is Buckbrush going to take over this entire valley?
Wright hesitated before saying,
Probably.
Then,
Believe me, mister, I don't like it either. I'm from a coal family, third generation. Do you think I like working for a wind outfit that helped put the mines out of business and pays me half of what I used to make? If I didn't have a wife and rugrats to feed...
Enough, Nate said.
15 minutes later, Nate rolled into the icy parking lot of the Encampment Lumber Mill. He parked in a slot between two pickups that apparently belonged to workers. When he opened his SUV door, the cold air was filled with the high whine of a vertical saw blade, and it smelled of sweet-cut pine. He had to mouth the words Jeb Pryor to a sawyer inside who was wearing a hard hat, safety glasses, and ear protection. The man pointed toward a door in the interior corner of the mill. Nate felt the eyes of mill employees on him as he traversed stacks of fresh-cut 2x4s and waded through ankle-high piles of sawdust. Obviously, they didn't get many visitors. Because the scream of the saw was so loud that it would be unlikely anyone inside the office could hear a knock on the door, he opened it a few inches and stuck his head inside.
Jeb Pryor?
An older, powerfully built man with a wide face and thick white hair looked up from a stack of orders on his desk. His face was wrinkled and weather-beaten, and his meaty hands were scarred from years of hard outside labor. His arched eyebrows indicated that, yes, he was Jeb Pryor.
Nate stepped inside the small office and closed the door. It muted the sound of the saws and machinery, but didn't completely block them out.
Joe Pickett asked me to come, Nate said. He said you called him.
Who are you, and why didn't he come himself? Pryor didn't talk so much as boom. Nate attributed it to years of hearing loss and trying to make himself heard over chainsaws and heavy equipment.
He had to go to Cheyenne today.
And you are?
Nate Romanowski.
Romanowski, Pryor said, while pointing Nate toward a chair in front of the desk. I used to work with some tough old poleaxe up in the timber. We called them the ski bums because all their names ended in ski like yours. Hard workers, though. One of them cut his own hand off at the wrist with a chainsaw, and he picked it up with his other good hand and pretended to wave it at his pals. After that, they all quit and went to work in the mines in Kemmerer. Are you related to any of them?
Not that I know of.
Because they were crazy, those poleaxe.
Sounds like it.
You kind of have that crazy look in your eye, I'd say.
Nate said, I call it deliberate, not crazy.
Pryor grinned. So you're working with the new game warden? Nate nodded. What are you, his deputy?
Of sorts.
I did a little research on him after I met him the other day. He's got a reputation, you know?
I'm aware of that.
Is he as trustworthy as he seems? I ask because I've run into a few game wardens who weren't, and don't even get me started on the feds.
Nate said, he's the most trustworthy man I know. He's a straight arrow, sometimes to a fault.
That's the impression I got when I met him, Pryor said. Did he really arrest the governor of Wyoming once for fishing without a license?
That was him.
Damn.
You called him this morning, Nate said, trying to get on track.
Pryor nodded his head. He said, I've got a knucklehead working here named Wiley Fry. He's my night man in charge of the burner out there. You know, that teepee-looking thing.
Yes.
Wiley's been letting somebody on my property at night. I just found out about it. Nate raised his eyebrows, urging Pryor on. I'll get right to it, the lumber mill owner said. I think Wiley has allowed somebody to cremate bodies in my burner, and I think they're bringing another one here tonight. You think your Joe Pickett would be interested to find out about that? Nate followed Pryor out of the mill and through the parking lot toward the conical burner on the far edge of the mill property. There was no wood smoke coming from the stack. A rusty metal shack was next to it. Nate asked,
Why haven't you called the local cops about this?
For one, I just got suspicious about it because I overheard Wiley talking on a cell phone last night. He wouldn't fess up to who was on the other end or what he was talking about. Second, our one local cop is a peckerwood named Spanks. He's the type who would screw up a train wreck.
What about the county sheriff?
Neil, Pryor said. He's a good egg, but he's got some people in his department I'm not so sure about. This is a small, isolated valley, Romanowski. Everyone knows everyone. There are some powerful people here. I have no doubt, if I called the sheriff's department, somebody would make a quick call to whoever is bringing the bodies here and tip them off. We might never find them, or they could shut my mill down while they investigate. I can't afford to have the mill shut down. My bankers are just waiting to move in and take it over as it is. I think they want to sell out to the Saratoga mill. He paused near the base of the burner and turned to Nate. If my saws shut down, my cash flow stops. I'm leveraged to the hilt, and I'm competing with those big boys in Saratoga. If I can't pay my loans, all those men you saw up there in the mill will be on the street. Not to mention the lumberjacks up in the mountains and the truckers who deliver our raw material. I could have just fired Wiley Fry and kept my mouth shut, Pryor said, but I just couldn't live with that. So I thought maybe Pickett could look into it with a fresh set of eyes. Didn't Governor Roulon give Pickett assignments outside of his game warden duties?
Yes,
Pryor said. I loved Governor Roulon, even though he was a damn Democrat. If Roulon trusted Pickett, then I do too. Nate nodded. There was no reason to tell Pryor about Joe's recent experiences with the new governor. Follow me, Pryor said, as he turned the metal handle of the burner hatch door and stepped inside. Even though the fire inside had been out for hours and the temperature outside was below zero, the interior of the burner was close and warm. Cold white light filtered down from the steel mesh cone directly above them and lit up tiny particles of ash hanging in the air. The ash on the floor of the burner was fine, white, and ankle deep. Pryor said, "Every other week or so, I've gotten a couple of calls from Mrs. Schmidt. Her house is about 300 yards away. That the burner was overheating and putting out too much smoke in the middle of the night. I asked him about it, but Wiley Fry assured me that he was following the procedure and that there wasn't anything to worry about. Mrs. Schmidt is a nice old lady and all, but she's known for complaining about things."
"Schmidt?"
Nate repeated. "Carol," Pryor said. "The poor old lady's in the hospital in Rawlins. She went off the road and was trapped in her car all night. I don't know how she'd live through it."
"I heard about that,"
Nate said, recalling what the waitress had told them. "Anyway," Pryor said, "when this burner's really cranking with sawdust, it can get to nearly 1,000 degrees in here. We try not to ever let it get that hot because I worry about the structural integrity of the steel." As he said that, he knocked on the interior wall with his knuckles. "Do you know how hot a crematorium gets in order to dispose of a human body?" Pryor asked. Then he answered his own question. "Between 1400 and 1800 degrees, hot enough to make the bones break down into sand. It doesn't take much imagination to figure that a guy could get this burner about that hot." Nate wished Joe were there. Joe was better at connecting dots, and he'd talk to more people in the valley. Nate committed what Pryor was telling him to memory. "Do you know what a burned corpse smells like?" Pryor asked.
"Yes."
"Military?"
"Special forces."
"I thought so," Pryor said. "You have that special operator thing going. I was an airborne ranger." Nate nodded. Pryor had that thing as well. Pryor said, "Take a whiff." Nate did. The odor of the burned pine sawdust was overpowering. But within it there was just a trace of something acrid and sweet, like burned hair or pork. "Mrs. Schmidt complained about that too," Pryor said. "She said she thought we were burning garbage." As his eyes adjusted to the darkness, Nate shuffled his boots through the ash on the floor. It was powdery and light, but there was grit on the bottom of it. He said,
"I wonder if a forensic scientist could sift through this and find something besides wood ash."
"I wonder that too," Pryor said. "We use the skid steer to clean it out when the ash gets above 10 inches. Then we spread it on the field out in back of the mill. The material is so fine it's absorbed by the soil or it blows away in the wind. But it's possible if experts went through it after our visitors come, they could find some kind of remains, I suppose." Nate looked up.
"The remains of Kate Shelford Longden, for example?"
Pryor groaned. He said, "I guess it's possible. But I don't think that lady is really missing. I think she'll show up somewhere." Pryor, Nate thought,
was echoing what seemed to be the prevalent theory in the area. Nate wasn't sure there was enough room inside the burner for more than one conspiracy theorist.
"Where could the bodies come from?"
he asked Pryor.
"Are there a lot of missing people around here?" "A few, I suppose," he said. "Or maybe someone's bringing them here from a long distance. There's all kind of crap with gangs and such going on in Denver and Phoenix. Maybe they're driving up and getting rid of bodies here."
"Maybe."
"I was also thinking Pickett could take a look at the funeral homes in the area," Pryor said. "Maybe one of them cut a deal with Wiley to do cremations on the cheap. Most folks wouldn't know the difference between ash from a body or from a wood burner, would be my guess."
Nate continued to shuffle his feet through the ash. Then he felt something larger than grit under the sole of his boot. He bent over and plunged his hand into the material. The warm ash was cloying and still warm. He felt something solid and grasped it.
"What did you find?" Pryor asked, moving in.
"I'm not sure,"
Nate said as he blew on his hand and the object to clear both of the ash. He used the illuminated screen of his phone to look closer. The intense heat had discolored and elongated it, but there was no doubt he was holding what looked like a band or a ring. It was several times thicker in width than a wedding band and lighter in weight. Nate didn't want to tell Pryor just yet that he thought he knew where it came from. Instead,
"Is Wiley Fry still in town?"
"As far as I know," Pryor said. "I wasn't going to fire him outright until I could train his replacement. He doesn't seem like the type to have anywhere else to go."
"Let's go find the son of a bitch,"
Nate said. Nate pocketed the ring and jabbed Joe's cell phone number on his phone. The cartoon image of Dudley Do-Right appeared on the screen, but Joe didn't pick up. As he followed Jeb Pryor across the yard toward their vehicles, Nate left a voice message.
"Call me back."
Chapter 27. Joe took a seat in a chair directly across the table from Steve Pollock, who listed to his side as if slightly deflated. Pollock, who to Joe had always looked well-groomed and put together for a game warden, had a 3 or 4 day growth of whiskers on his cheeks and neck, and his hair was unkempt. His eyes were so bloodshot that Joe felt his own eyes tear up with some kind of odd empathy. Michael Williams was perched on the far left end of the booth seat as if he might spring from it and run toward the door at any second. Either that or he wanted to get as far away from Pollock as possible but still be in the booth. The ex-game warden smelled of musk and stale whiskey. The waitress arrived before a word was spoken between any of the three men. Joe and Williams ordered black coffee. Pollock said, "You know what I want," and she smiled and strode back to the order station at the bar.
"Do you two know each other?" Joe asked.
"We met over in my district," Pollock said, as his draft beer and a shot of Wyoming whiskey were put down in front of him. "Mike asked me if I knew anything about that disappearance of Kate, what's her name?"
"Kate Shelford Longdon," Williams interjected. Joe nodded.
"Mike and I aren't friends or anything," Pollock said. "We hardly know each other besides that. Just a couple of state employees."
His voice was lazy and a bit slurry. Joe guessed that the order in front of Pollock wasn't his first of the day.
"What did you tell him about Kate?"
Joe asked.
"I don't remember any interview notes in the file."
Williams sat up. He was more than a little defensive. "That's because there was nothing to write up. Pollock said he'd never seen her or met her, and he had no intel to share with me."
Pollock said, "That's true. There are lots of fancy people coming and going at the Silver Creek Ranch. I rarely seen any of them except if they decided to come to town at night, like at the Wolf or something. Occasionally, I'd see a bunch of them riding nose to tail on ranch horses pretending to be cowboys, but I never really talked to them. That place runs a really clean operation, Pollock continued. I never had any trouble with them over the years. Mark Gordon is tightly wrapped, but he doesn't want his guests breaking any game and fish rules or regulations. I hardly ever got called out there, and if I was, it was to help shoo away elk from their haystacks. But that was the winter, when they didn't have guests. I remember one time there was a moose just walking right through their fence lines. That bull was dragging about 100 yards of barbed wire behind him and didn't even act like he knew it. William shot his hand so he could see his watch below his jacket sleeve. He said, I'm sure it's a good story, but I can't stay long. My supervisor doesn't want me working on Sundays and racking up overtime hours. Pollock paused in mid-sentence and looked over, amused. You're kind of wrapped tight yourself, he said to the DCI agent. Look, William said to Joe and Pollock, I shouldn't even be here. I can only stay as long as my normal lunch break, and I can't spend the whole time listening to elk and moose stories from a couple of game wardens. I'll keep mine to myself, Joe said. Williams lowered his voice and bent forward across the table. He obviously didn't want to be overheard by the waitress or the bartender. Pollock asked me to come here and meet you before he left the state. I agreed, because there's something going on over there, and I thought maybe if the three of us traded notes, we could figure out what it is. Joe wondered if Williams or Pollock knew of his own circumstances. Could the news of his firing be public knowledge in Cheyenne already? I hope you found my notes helpful, William said. I did, Joe said. They saved me weeks of plowing the same ground, but somebody broke into my hotel room and took them. William said, That's exactly what I'm talking about. Things like that happen over there. The whole time my team was investigating Kate's disappearance, we had the feeling that we were being watched and observed. We reported everything we were doing to the Carbon County Sheriff's Office, and I think there's a couple of leakers there. My guy said they saw strange trucks parked down the street in the morning when they went outside, things like that. Joe recalled the same experience outside Pollock's former home. William said, When we didn't get any immediate leads in and around the ranch, we did our job and expanded the search. We were methodical about it. But it seemed like the farther we got away from the immediate area, the more we were being monitored. And when we were pulled off the case, we puzzled over it for weeks. We asked ourselves, who did we offend? Who wanted us gone? Joe was interested in the answer. It didn't come. I know the governor is an impatient man, William said. To pull us out of there like that was humiliating. We've never worked for a governor so quick to piss inside his own tent. But I guess you know a little about that. Joe felt his neck flush hot. I do, he said. I heard the press conference this morning. It sounded familiar. If I were you, I'd keep my head on a swivel, Williams advised. Joe concluded that his firing hadn't been publicized yet, and he was grateful. Joe turned to Pollock and arched his eyebrows. Pollock's vague smile turned sour. Well, Joe asked, why did you quit the way you did? The story was longer than it needed to be, and Joe was aware of Williams fidgeting as it went on and on. Pollock gave the background. His wife, Lindy, left and took the kids because she said he worked too many hours and was distracted when he was home. Then the divorce. Then the state froze all salaries, and he was looking at ending his career eventually without ever building a nest egg or owning any real assets like a home of his own. He felt trapped,
and the bureaucracy was getting worse by the month. He didn't get along with agency director Linda Green Dempsey, and the department had cut his district down from a 3-horse district to a 0-horse district. He could see the writing on the wall, he said.
"They were putting the squeeze on me," Pollock said, hoping I'd quit eventually. "LGD isn't comfortable with us old school game wardens. She wants to replace us all with younger, greener versions. You know that, Joe."
Joe nodded, hoping Pollock would get to the point.
"I was doing my job," he said. "The Kate investigation was going on in the background. Then all of a sudden, I got a visitor at my office. His name is Ted Panos," Pollock said. "Do either of you know him?"
Joe said he didn't. William said he thought he might have heard the name, but he couldn't place it.
"From what I understand, he works for Buckbrush," Pollock said. "I really didn't check him out at the time, and the reason is he offered me $175,000 to hit the bricks."
Joe sat back, stunned.
$175K is $175K more than I had in the bank," Pollock said. He couldn't have timed it better because I was sick and tired of life at the time. All I could think about was being on some beach in the sun instead of bucking snowdrifts every day. "I said yes, and he delivered it in 3 suitcases the next morning. I packed some clothes, and that was about it. I was gone. It was an impulsive decision on my part, I know. But I'm still gone. I ain't ever going back."
Joe was disgusted at Pollock's decision to abandon his district like that, but he tried not to show it. He measured his words carefully.
"What did he ask you to do for that kind of money?"
"Nothing," Pollock said. "Just leave."
"Just like that?"
"It was an easy decision at the time," Pollock said. "Tell me you wouldn't do the same."
Joe tried not to think about his own circumstances at the moment and how he might be tempted to take a quick buyout for the sake of his family.
"Did you take any of your files with you?"
"No,"
Pollock said. "I left all my official records in place for the next poor son of a bitch who takes over."
"Let me ask you," Joe said. "Did you keep a file on the Silver Creek Ranch?"
"Sure."
"Some of the files are gone now," Joe said, "including that one."
"Really?"
"I was in the old house, and I went through your desk. There are missing files, including the ranch records. Also, the B files are missing."
Pollock sat back and rubbed his chin, trying to recall what was gone.
Williams asked, "Was there a Buckbrush file?"
Pollock nodded.
"Of course there was."
"Not anymore," Joe said.
At that moment, his phone lit up and started to skitter across the table. It was Nate. Nate never called, but Joe couldn't interrupt the conversation to take it, and he let it go to voicemail.
Pollock said, "Are you thinking what I'm thinking? That Panos went back and took a bunch of stuff from my office after I left?"
"There wasn't anyone to stop him, was there?"
Joe said.
He withdrew his notebook and opened it to a fresh page. On the top line, he wrote the name Ted Panos. On the second line, he wrote Buckbrush. Joe noticed that Williams had gone silent since he'd asked Pollock his question. The man was recalling something. William said to Pollock, "Did you ever run across a guy named Galen Kessel?"
"Sure,"
Pollock said. He said it in a way that indicated he didn't like him.
"Who's Galen Kessel?" Joe asked.
"The point man for Buckbrush Power," Williams answered.
"More like a security specialist of some kind," Pollock said.
"He bigfoots his way around the county like he owns the place. People suck up to him because of who he works for."
Williams placed his hand on Pollock's arm to quiet him for a moment.
"As we were casting our net wider on the Kate case, we got farther and farther away from Silver Creek Ranch. You know, we were thinking that maybe when she left, she took a wrong turn for some reason, that maybe she went north instead of south. As you know, the entire north is the Buckbrush Power Project. We thought maybe, and we knew it was a stretch, she got lost and maybe ended up on the project. Or maybe she was taken somewhere else and her body dumped up there, so I made a request to interview the man in charge.
Galen Kessel, Joe said. Williams nodded.
He was a prick about it. He said he didn't want anyone thinking her disappearance had anything to do with the project, that it was bad PR for the company. I told him I'd be discreet, but he said he was in charge of keeping Buckbrush's public image safe. He said it was his job to make sure the company was seen in a positive light, given their $5 billion investment, and that us even associating a missing woman with the company was outrageous.
Joe wrote the name Galen Kessel on his page. We never had the interview, because later that week the governor pulled the plug on the investigation,
Williams said.
Joe asked, Are you thinking your contact with Kessel and Buckbrush was the reason you were yanked?
I never made the connection until now, Williams said. I'd kind of forgotten about it. But when Pollock said they paid him off, it just clicked.
Pollock winced at the phrase, paid him off, Joe noted.
Williams said, I wouldn't be surprised if Panos worked for Kessel.
Joe turned to Pollock. He said, Steve, you need to think. Why would they want you gone? Did someone call in a violation up on the project that you were planning to check out?
Pollock shook his head. I honestly can't think of anything like that. There were lots of grumbling about the size of the project and how the company was able to skirt around all the environmental impact studies because they represent clean energy and that's what the feds want. And because the project is all on private property, I'd need permission from them to even go there, so I steered clear of that mess.
Joe nodded. But there had to be something, he said. Something in another of the missing files. Something related to either Kate or Buckbrush or both. Pollock reached for his beer and Joe slid it away before he could grasp it. Think, he said. Then drink. Pollock sat back and closed his eyes. It went on for over a minute. Joe and Williams exchanged looks. Then Pollock's eyes shot open.
You said there was no Silver Creek Ranch file in the S's?
Correct.
Was there a file that said Eagle permits?
I don't recall one, Joe said. I think I would have remembered because I talked to a falconer the other day who was complaining that he can't get the feds to grant him a permit to hunt with eagles.
Pollock slapped the table with his palm. He said, That might be the connection.
Williams looked over, obviously puzzled.
Pollock said to Joe, I had a whole file of complaint letters from pissed-off falconers who aren't allowed to use the eagle permits they've earned. They've got this big conspiracy theory about how the feds are granting take permits to wind energy companies, and even the governor's office is looking the other way.
Joe said, I've heard it. He didn't say he'd heard it from his friend Nate just the previous night.
What's a take permit? Williams asked. Joe said, it allows wind energy companies to kill up to a certain number of golden and bald eagles legally without penalty.
What?
It's true, Pollock said. There's a company up by Glen Rock, Wyoming, that killed over 40 golden eagles last year, and those are just the birds we know about. The falconers think the feds are denying them eagles to hunt with because so many birds are being slaughtered by wind turbines.
I thought eagles were an endangered species, Williams asked.
Not for renewable energy companies, Pollock said. Their take permits exempt them from the law. Those falconers who complained said the general public would go ballistic if they knew about all the dead eagles, and they're probably right. but few people know, and our government makes sure the take permit program stays below the radar. The worst part of the program is that the companies are asked to self-report the eagle deaths. How many of them do you think are likely to do that once they have exceeded their take permit? Joe said to Pollock, "Were you going to follow up on those complaints with Buck Brush?" "Eventually," Pollock said. "I was waiting for the dead months in the winter between big game seasons when I had some time." That's when Ted Panos came a-calling, Joe said. "I guess so," Pollock agreed. Joe said, $175,000 is a lot less than millions of dollars in fines if Buck Brush got caught exceeding their take permit. And that doesn't include the cost of massive bad publicity. It was a business decision. Pollock closed his eyes. He said, "I came cheap." "Yep. I'll see if I'm able to live with myself." Joe eyed him with disdain. He was disappointed by Pollock, and Pollock knew it. To Williams, Joe said, "Kessel probably didn't want you to go up there to his project because you might see something he didn't want you to see." "Dead eagles," Williams said. "But what about Kate? Do you think it's possible she went there?" Joe had no answer. He circled the name Galen Kessel on his pad so many times the ballpoint of his pen nearly cut through to the next page. Then the three men simply looked at one another for a few minutes, absorbed in the revelations and their own thoughts. As Williams got up, he put his hand on Joe's shoulder. "I gotta go," he said, "but be careful. It seems like if you get too close to Buckbrush like Steve and I did, something bad might happen to you." Joe said, "It already has." Joe felt a weight crushing down on him as he went outside toward his pickup, and he felt duplicitous. He hadn't told the two men that he'd been fired by Hanlon, that he was there with them at the table under what could be deemed false pretenses. He'd had several opportunities to do so, but he hadn't taken them. The fact was he was ashamed and embarrassed by being taken off the job. It was what defined him, as well as being a husband and a father. The news of his canning would get out. It would be a matter of days or even hours. He was operating on borrowed time, and he'd implicated both Williams and Pollock in his deception. The only answer was to try and end this thing before word got out. Joe decided to return Nate's call once he got back on the road to Saratoga. But first, he needed to think about what he'd learned. The governor's two biggest campaign contributors, Missy and Buckbrush, had both gotten what they wanted. Things were falling into place, and not in a good way. Chapter 28. Sheridan Pickett was getting anxious. After spending Sunday morning chopping water holes in the ice and gathering the guest horses she'd ride and exercise later that day, she'd returned to Silver Creek Ranch to find that Lance Ramsey hadn't shown up for work. She'd zipped up her coat against the cold and looked for signs of him with a rising sense of dread. His truck and snowmobile trailer weren't in the lot in front of the indoor arena, nor in the pull-through of the activity center. She couldn't remember when he'd been so late to work before. There was no cell service where his cabin was located, and no way to reach him. He'd told her he liked being off the grid for a few days at a time, that it gave him a sense of calm, and she'd not been able to convince him otherwise. As she checked for his truck at the employee housing units in the outdoor rodeo arena, unwelcome scenarios played out in her head. She thought, his snowmobile wouldn't start this morning and it's 7 miles from the parking area. Or, He's gotten his snowmobile or his truck stuck in the snow getting out from the cabin. Or worse, he's gotten stuck on the way there 2 days ago, and he's stranded. Or even worse, an avalanche swept through the little valley where the cabin is located and buried him beneath several tons of snow. Or maybe he's deathly ill and is trembling and feverish in his single bed with no way to call her for help, sick in that same iron-framed bed where they... Sheridan had started the morning with anticipation. She couldn't wait to tell him about the raid on the mountain and how she'd clocked the fleeing subject with the door of her dad's truck. Or that her image from the back standing over the injured man had appeared in newspapers and on websites all over the world. She didn't like the photo because it looked like she was threatening the poor man. But nonetheless, it was her. Sheridan didn't want General Manager Mark Gordon to know Lance hadn't made it back from the weekend because she didn't want him to get in trouble. But if he didn't show up soon, she might have to. The ranch had a fleet of snowmobiles, and she could use one of them to go up into the mountains and try to find him. Her dad was in Cheyenne, and Nate was in encampment, so she'd have to go by herself if it came to that. Plus, she missed Lance. She missed him more than she wanted to admit to herself. The ranch in the winter was a lonely and hollow place without his shy smile and his steady presence. After looking everywhere she could think of, Sheridan finally went to the office. Gordon sat at his desk with his back to her, answering email on his computer. "Mark, have you heard anything from Lance? He hasn't shown up today from his cabin, and he's usually back by now." Gordon wheeled around, concerned. "He hasn't let us know he was coming back late, if that's what you mean." "I'm starting to get worried." "I don't blame you. There's a lot of snow out there. Do you want me to call the sheriff's department?" She shook her head. To ask them to do another blind raid on a mountain cabin, they might not be real excited to do that again.
"I see your point.
If it's okay with you, I'd like to borrow one of the snowmobiles to see if I can find him." Gordon enthusiastically agreed. He said,
"Take a satellite phone and call me every hour to check in. I don't want two of my people lost. Do you know where his cabin is?"
She looked down at her boots. "Yes."
"Oh," Gordon said simply.
He handed the keys over without further comment, and she took them and trudged back through the snow toward the activity center. So now Gordon knew. She hoped he wouldn't remind her of what a bad idea it was for senior employees to fraternize, because she and Lance were well aware of it. Both of them had counseled junior employees against it. Still, it had happened. It was important to her to know that her dad seemed to genuinely like Lance. The next test would be to see what her mother thought of him. That time would come. But first, she had to find him. Sheridan stumbled a bit when she saw that a beige 3/4-ton GMC pickup was parked outside the activity center. Large, opened gearboxes filled the bed of the truck. Stenciled on the driver's side door was Youngberg Farrier Service. She knew they often used the old stalls in the building for putting on new horseshoes in the winter, but she hadn't heard they were scheduled for today. In any other circumstance, she would have turned on her heel and walked back to the arena to wait them out. But this wasn't any other circumstance, and she put her head down and kept going. Inside the long building was a long central walkway with storage room doors on both sides and horse stalls at the far end. Cold white winter light poured down through the overhead skylights inside and lit up the floating dust from the farrier activity. She could see Ben and Brady in silhouette outside the stalls. Ben was bent over an iron anvil, holding up a horse's leg clamped between his knees,
and tapping nail after nail through the shoe into its hoof.
Brady was preparing to do the same procedure with a different horse when he saw her come in.
"Well, look who's here," Brady said.
"Who?"
Ben asked, through a mouthful of nails in his mouth. He put them there for easy access.
"Little miss," Brady said.
Ben paused in mid-swing of his hammer and looked up.
"Little miss," he mumbled through the nails.
She didn't know they called her that. She said,
"I don't want any trouble with you two. I'll only be here long enough to get a snowmobile and trailer out of here."
"She don't want no trouble," Brady said. "Little miss don't want no trouble."
His tone was mocking and amused. She narrowed her eyes at them and vowed to herself not to say anything that would provoke them. Not now.
Brady asked,
"Do you have your daddy with you? And where's Lance Romance, your bodyguard?"
So they had names for them both. "I seen your picture on my phone," Brady said.
"Were you standing over that poor guy in the snow telling him he better watch out or your daddy and Lance Romance would come beat him up?"
Ben laughed and several nails fell out of his mouth into the dirt. His whole body shook when he laughed. She could still hear him laughing when she went through the door into an oversized storage garage and closed the door behind her, then locked it. 10 Polaris snowmobiles were lined up on individual trailers. 8 were 550 wide tracks for getting around on the ranch, and 2 were 800 Titans big enough for 2 or 3 riders. Shallow tubs were attached to the Titans for hauling junk and equipment from place to place on the ranch in the winter. She filled a pack with emergency blankets, a first aid kit, and a handheld GPS unit and a satellite phone that both sat in charging stations. The keys Gordon had given her were for the lockbox mounted on the wall, where the keys for each machine were hung. She selected keys for one of the Titans, thinking that if Lance were injured, she could bring him out in the tub and call ahead for the EMTs to meet her. Sheridan was grateful that there was an overhead garage door on the far side of the room. That way, she could back her truck in and drive away with the snowmobile without having to confront the Youngbergs and their taunting again. But the first thing she saw when she began to raise the door to the outside were 4 heavy boots in the snow. The door rolled up smoothly, and there they were. Brady wore his sloppy grin, and Ben stood with his hands on his hips and his chin raised. There was a dribble of brown tobacco juice hanging from his chin.
"Do you need some help hooking that trailer up?" Brady asked.
"No."
"Are you one of those I can do anything a man can do type of gals?"
"One of them feminists?" Brady added.
"No." "Which one of these snow machines do you need?"
She nodded toward the Titan.
"Please step aside. I need to go get my truck."
To her surprise, they did.
But she could feel their eyes on her backside as she made her way to her pickup.
There was a lever action 30-30 just inside the door if she needed it. She didn't.
Ben guided her as she backed up to the open garage, and Brady was strong enough to lift the snowmobile trailer and roll it forward on its wheels so they could hitch it up easily. "Thank you," she said out her driver's side window.
"Anything for you, little miss," Brady said to Ben's laugh.
She kept waiting for the other shoe to drop.
It did, as she started to pull away, when Brady jogged alongside her open window and waved for her to stop. She did, but she kept her finger poised on the button that would close it.
"Maybe when you find him, you'll figure out why we call him Lance Romance," he said.
"What are you talking about?"
Brady didn't answer.
Instead, he looked over at his brother, and the two of them exchanged wide smiles as she drove away. Then she thought, how did they know Lance was missing?
Chapter 29. Wiley Fry lived in a two-story white clapboard house on the corner of Freeman and 8th Streets in Encampment. The streets weren't paved, but they'd been plowed to their frozen gravel surface, and the excess snow bordered the lanes like tall white cornrows. The Sierra Madre Range loomed blue and sharp over the entire town to the south and west. Pryor pulled his truck parallel to the left side wall of snow and got out. Nate pulled in behind him. Wood was obviously the heating fuel of choice in the little town, Nate observed. A layer of smoke hung above the houses at treetop level. A curl of it emanated from Fry's chimney, and Pryor pointed it out.
"Looks like he's home," Pryor said in a near whisper.
"You knock on the door," Nate said. "I'll go around back."
Pryor hitched up his jeans and waited to give Nate time to go around. Condensation from his breath hung about his head like a thought balloon. Nate high-stepped it through knee-high snow through the front lawn and around the large garage. It was obvious the garage wasn't used to store Wiley's vehicle, which was parked on the side of the building with an extension cord plugged into the engine block to keep it warm. Nate glanced through a window on the side of the structure to see inside. The interior was a work in progress, a shop, den, and man cave rolled into one. There were big game mounts on the walls, a pool table covered with loose plastic, a wood stove, a bar that looked like it had just been installed, a 70-inch Vizio television, an overstuffed lounge chair. Stacks of 2x4s and wood scraps on the floor indicated that Fry was still working on the room. He peered around the corner toward the back of the adjacent home. There was no back fence, but Nate could see a porch and back door. He unzipped the front of his parka so he could access his weapon. In a moment, he heard a heavy rapping from the front of the house, and Jeb Pryor shout,
"Wiley, it's Jeb! Open up! I need to talk to you."
Nate waited. He could feel the cold of the deep snow start to seep into his boots and through his trousers. Then he heard footfalls inside the house and the sound of the back door being opened. The secondary storm door pushed out toward the porch, and Nate saw a rotund man with a heavy beard come out and step heavily down the concrete steps. He wore an insulated Carhartt coat and a stormy Cromer cap with ear flaps, and he turned toward where Nate was located near Fry's pickup. Nate stepped out from the corner of the garage and leveled his .454 at Wiley Fry's chest.
"Where are you going?"
Nate asked. Fry stopped so quickly he nearly topped over forward. His eyes widened on the large O of Nate's muzzle.
"Aren't you going to invite us inside?"
Nate asked. Fry straightened up and sighed. Nate hoped the man wasn't stupid enough to reach for a gun of his own. No doubt he had one. Everyone in Encampment did.
"Do I have a choice?"
Fry asked.
"Nope."
"I ain't done nothing wrong," Fry said. "You're on private property, you know."
"Turn around," Nate said. "That's quite a workshop you've got going here. It's hard to believe Jeb pays you enough for all of that."
"Are you some kind of cop?"
Fry asked.
"The worst kind," Nate said. "The kind without a badge or rules."
Wiley Fry started to say something, but apparently thought better of it. He turned and shambled toward his back door. Nate followed him inside and found himself in the kitchen. The place was a mess, dishes piled in the sink, a tall garbage can overflowing with empty beer bottles, a linoleum floor caked with dried mud and snow so thick the original design was obscured.
"Don't tell me,"
Nate said.
"You live alone."
ever since Ginny left with the kids, Fry said. It's hard to maintain the place for the hours I work.
Yeah, yeah.
Nate stepped around Fry, but kept his eye on him as he opened the front door.
Jeb Pryor entered, along with a blast of cold air from outside. Pryor closed the door and stood off to the side of the door jamb, indicating it was Nate's play. He looked like he was unsure of the situation he was now in.
Take off your coat and let it drop to the floor,
Nate told Fry.
Then your gun.
Fry hesitated for a second before removing the coat and doing what he'd been instructed to do. The grip of a semi-automatic was shoved into the front of his waistband.
Take it out using your thumb and index finger and lower it to your coat. I don't want it going off by you dropping it on the floor.
Fry grunted as he placed his weapon on his jacket. He wasn't flexible enough to bend all the way over.
Okay, Nate said. Thank you.
He stepped forward and pinned the sleeve of Fry's coat under his boot and slid it and the gun toward him. It was a shiny new Smith & Wesson Model 1911 45.
This is a $1,000 pistol,
Nate said.
Jeb must be paying you pretty well.
Fry and Pryor exchanged glances. Fry looked guilty. Nate handed the pistol to Pryor, who looked it over.
Not this well, Pryor said.
There was disappointment in his voice. He lowered the muzzle to the floor. Nate riffled through the pockets in Fry's parka and found two cell phones, a Samsung smartphone and a cheap prepaid flip phone. Fry said,
You've got no business going through my coat.
Call the cops,
Nate said. Fry didn't move.
Why do you need two phones?
Nate asked. Fry didn't answer.
Why do you need a burner?
Nate asked, flipping the device open and turning it on.
Please, mister, Fry said.
There was desperation in his voice. He turned to Pryor.
You can't just let him do this, boss.
Pryor shrugged. Nate found a single text thread on the flip phone with a lone text that read, He knows. It had been sent the day before to an unknown number.
Who knows?
Nate asked Fry, who screwed up his face like he was going to cry. He simply glared at Fry. Nate often found that silence was the best way to get someone to talk. Finally, the man nodded toward Pryor.
He knows,
he said in a near whisper.
I know what? You never fessed up what was going on,
Pryor boomed. He couldn't help it. Fry looked helplessly toward his boss, then to Nate. He said,
These guys scare me.
I'm going to scare you worse,
Nate growled. To Pryor,
hold him here.
Nate went out the front door to his SUV and found the brown trout. It had frozen solid into the shape of a 4-pound club. It looked like an oversized prehistoric billy club. Nate grasped it in front of the tail and took it back inside. Fry was saying to Pryor, I don't want to be involved with them anymore. Nate raised the trout club and swung it at Fry like a baseball bat. It landed hard on his ribcage, and Fry's knees buckled and he dropped to the floor. Pryor stepped back, as if to distance himself from the act as much as he could. Nate swept Fry's hat off his head with a backhand, then grasped the man's left ear. He was so close, Nate could smell wood smoke on Fry's clothing.
Sometimes I pull these right off. They make a popping sound.
Please, mister, Fry begged.
So you told them the delivery is off,
Nate said. Fry nodded as best he could. He hugged himself and struggled for breath.
Have they responded to you?
You can see they haven't. Fry said in a wheeze.
I'm going to give you back your phone, and you're going to text them and tell them you made a mistake. Tell them the delivery is back on.
I think you broke my ribs, Fry moaned.
Your nose is next, Nate said. I'm just getting started.
When Fry looked up, Nate handed him the flip phone.
Don't screw it up.
What if they don't believe me?
Then you'll have both of us to worry about,
Nate said.
It's your job to make them believe you.
Fry reached up gingerly and took the phone. Nate watched as he tapped out the message.
Let me see it.
Fry held up the phone. He'd written, "False alarm, I was being cautious," spelled C-A-U-S-H-U-S. It's still a go at the usual time. Nate said,
send it.
He figured if he corrected Fry's spelling, it might appear suspicious. Fry sent the message.
Can I get up now? I done what you said.
There's more. Show up to work tonight like normal, Nate said. Play your role and don't do anything clever like trying to contact them again. You don't seem like a very clever guy.
I don't want no part in this anymore, Fry whined.
Too late,
Nate said.
You took the money and betrayed your